Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Who was Michelangelo, and what makes his work as fresh and unforgettable today as it was in the 16th century? Few artists in history have left such an indelible mark on the world, and as my guest today will tell us, Michelangelo blazed a trail not only as a peerless painter, sculptor, and architect, but also as an advocate for valuing individual artists' ideas over the whims of their patrons. Miles J. Unger is a former contributing writer for the New York Times and former managing editor of Art New England. His new book is called Michelangelo, A Life in Six Masterpieces. Miles, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
What do you mean when you call Michelangelo the world's first modern artist?
Well, what I mean is that before Michelangelo's time, artists had generally been regarded as craftsmen, very skilled craftsmen, but more or less carpenters or anybody else who would serve in the household of a great lord or work to commissioned by a great lord. And already by the time Michelangelo began his career, this was beginning to change. Artists were more highly valued, they were more highly paid. But with Michelangelo, you really get the first artist for whom art is a form of self-expression. That is, if you can look at great works of other artists, and there seems to be less of themselves in it. But with Michelangelo, partly because of his sort of titanic ego and his sort of insecurities, needed to project himself into the work in a way that previous artists hadn't. There's a term that was coined to describe Michelangelo's work and the man himself, which was the Italian word terribilità, which doesn't really have a good translation, but means sort of awesome power, terrifyingness. And you really, if you see the Sistine Chapel or the Last Judgment, or the Moses, many of his great works, they exhibit this kind of power that you feel not only expresses the subject, but the artist himself. And this is sort of a new thing in the world, and this is sort of the way we begin to think of artists as people who are primarily there to project themselves through the work rather than simply carrying out the wishes of the patron.
So how much content would he allow his patrons to influence? In other words, would someone simply say, here is X amount of money, here is the medium I want the work in, go to town?
Well, this is something that Michelangelo struggled with all his life. I mean, he was born into a society in which the great lords, the popes, the dukes, the kings really called the shots, even when it came to works of art. They would, in Michelangelo's youth, and he worked in the shop of the Ghirlandaio brothers, who were a good example of a very successful Florentine art firm. And they would produce frescoes, but the patron had an enormous amount of input. They would often, determine how many figures would be in the composition, who would be in the composition. They would be very nitpicky about the pigments they chose and the expense. And they could determine such things as, whether there were angels in the composition, whether the angels should have wings. They would often interfere by saying, paint out this figure I want to meet. So the patron traditionally had an enormous amount of power. And when this is the world Michelangelo was born into, but this did not suit his personality at all. He had enormous need, he had enormous ego, and he struggled throughout his life to gain his independence, to gain his emancipation from the whim of the patron. And, with some patrons it was easier than with others. Pope Leo famously said, I'd like to work with him, but he is terrible. You can't work with this guy. He's just too difficult. He's too headstrong. He does what he wants to do. There's another case when he was working on the Basilica of St. Peter's, when the cardinal who was in charge of the finances for this immense and immensely expensive project complained to the Pope that, Michelangelo was working and I have no idea what he's doing. He doesn't tell me anything. And Michelangelo gets up in this kind of rage and says, I have no obligation to tell you what I'm doing. Your job is to pay the bills and mine is to make the art. And this was an unheard of thing in that time, and he could have gotten into a lot of trouble for it. Fortunately, this particular pope had his back and supported him in this, but it was always a struggle, and he, through the example of Michelangelo, you really have a change in the power relationship between patron and artist.
He wasn't above letting the patron think they were getting what they want. For example, somebody complaining about the shape of David's nose.
Right. Oh, that's an amusing incident when the leader of Florence, Piero Soderini, now the David was this big public work. This was and Florentines took their art very seriously. This was going to be a big civic monument that was meant to sort of rally the people around the government that was under siege. It was being attacked from without and political dissension within. So it was a very public and important piece. And the head of the Florentine state had a stake, you know, was really concerned with exactly how, you know, it would appear. So he goes into the shed where Michelangelo was working on the David and looks at it and, you know, scratches his chin and says, you know, I think you've made the nose too wide. So Michelangelo says, okay, well, he clambers up on the scaffolding and he pretends to take out his chisel and he takes in his hand a little bit of stone dust and starts, you know, making banging sounds and then dribbles a little of the dust on the ground and doesn't change anything but makes it look as if he has. And then he comes down and says, how do you like it now? And the head of state says, I like it much better now. So he was not above his nose at sort of making fun of patrons. This was one of the more sort of gentle interactions he had with his patrons. Usually they tended to be more angry and involve, you know, threats of throwing him off the scaffolding and other sort of more violent confrontations. But this was one where he was just sort of pulling his leg and showing that the sort of the know-it-alls who thought they, you know, should determine what the work of art looked like really didn't know anything, and that it was the artist who should take full responsibility for the work.
It's clear that, you know, that titanic talent gave him confidence, and yet his family background was pretty humble. Can you talk a little bit about his early life and how that played into the difficult sort of person he was, but also the very confident person he was?
Yeah, I think the main factor that shaped his psychology was the difficult circumstances of his youth. He was born into a family in Florence that considered itself very noble, that considered itself descended from the Counts of Canossa. That would have made them sort of the creme de la creme of Florentine society. This was mostly family lore. It was not necessarily confirmed, but it was widely accepted by both Michelangelo and his father and those around them. But his father was, in fact, very poor, so there was a gap between his sense of self, his sense that he was belonged to this great and noble family, and the daily humiliations of poverty he had to face. I mean, his father once famously told Lorenzo de' Medici, who was the ruler of Florence, he said, you know, I've never worked a day in my life, and he says this with pride, you know, I'm too much of an aristocrat to work, but then he had no money. And this sort of sense that Michelangelo had, both of enormous pride but also insecurity, I think fed his artistic ambition. I mean, he was also entering a profession that was considered beneath an aristocrat, and his father, despite his poverty, used to beat him when he first announced his intention to become an artist. But Michelangelo persevered, and ironically, it is his success and his fame as an artist that ultimately, you know, made the family's fortune. And, you know, no one would have heard of the Buonarroti family if it were not for the fact that the artist in the family brought them fame and fortune. So I think it was this kind of tension between kind of pride and humiliation that fueled his determination to sort of be the greatest artist who ever lived, and to also transform the role of the artist. It wasn't simply to be enough to be the greatest artist in the tradition of his colleagues, but he had to transform art itself into something more noble, a profession worthy of a great man.
I was not expecting to read that early in his career he got really good at forgeries.
Yeah, that's an interesting aspect of his early career. He used to, when he was a student in Ghirlandaio's studio, he used to take some of the drawings. There was a stash of drawings that the students would work from, some of them from old masters, from Donatello, and partly because he wanted to keep the originals for himself. What he would do, Michelangelo would do, is he was such a gifted and prolific and prodigious artist that he was able to completely mimic the style, and then he would use smoke and soak it in tea in order to make it look old, to antique it. And he learned this very early on, and then he sort of got his big career break by sculpting a statue of Cupid and then passing it off as an original and as an antique by burying it in the ground and scuffing it up. In Michelangelo's days, ancient art was valued much more highly, and he'd get a much bigger price, but it also was a way for him to prove his skill. If he could make a work of art that the experts could not distinguish from an ancient piece, then they would realize he was the equal of the great sculptors of the past. And this was sort of the great, when the forgery of the Cupid was discovered in Rome, that was what sort of made his, gave him his big break, and he was called to Rome and then went on to sculpt the famous Pietà.
Let's talk about the Pietà, because, first of all, the contract language when he got this gig was highly unorthodox.
Yeah. One of the things, he was very young at that time. He had really no great masterpieces to his name. He had just completed a sculpture of the Greek god of wine, Bacchus, for a cardinal. That was not very successful, at least in the cardinal's mind, and the cardinal ultimately rejected it. So he was sort of still a young, unknown man, unproven. But the contract, nonetheless, stipulated that the work that he was to make for another cardinal, a French cardinal, was to be the most beautiful in Rome. And so this was a very sort of ambitious, for a young, relatively unknown figure, the idea that he would, you know, equal or surpass any living sculptor was a perhaps an arrogant and did show an enormous amount of self-confidence and confidence on the part of his patron that he could pull it off. I think I say in the book that, you know, nobody complained that he did not fulfill the contract to the letter. So it was, once it was completed, was regarded as perhaps the greatest sculpture by a living artist.
And he made some interesting choices in the piece, not least of which is the fact that the Virgin Mary looks as young as the adult son that she's cradling.
Right, right. It's an interesting, there were many in contemporaries who sort of regarded this as sacrilegious, or at least incongruous, and were uncomfortable with it. And Michelangelo told his biographer that some story about, well, you know, that virgins, you know, being untouched by sin, it don't age the same, right? Which I think is, you know, was a line he was handing them for what was a more complicated and subtle issue. I think one of the things that happens because of that is it removes the kind of narrative, that kind of mother-child anguish that is so much a part of earlier Pietas. You know, the idea that, you know, this was a very human story in which, you know, a mother is grieving over her dead child. And some of the early versions of the Pietà, the mother is almost unhinged with grief. But Michelangelo treats this as a much more contemplative, in a much more contemplative fashion. It's much more serene. Mary is, there's a melancholy to it. There's a mournfulness to it. But it's not this kind of unhinged, you know, human drama.
Let me jump in. We have to take a quick break. My guest is Miles J. Unger, author of Michelangelo, A Life in Six Masterpieces.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration opens August 5th. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Miles J. Unger, former managing editor of Art New England and contributing writer for the New York Times. His new book is called Michelangelo, A Life in Six Masterpieces. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think at kera.org. Miles, what did Michelangelo see as the reason for creating art?
I think for him personally, art was a, he was one of these people who very young had a compulsion to create art, and the fact that he had to defy his family and suffer the beatings from his father and uncle to do it showed that it fulfilled a deep-seated need in him. But art at that time was a very much a part of sort of almost the air he breathed. He was born into 15th century Florence, which is probably has an unparalleled tradition of art making. Have such great artists as Masaccio and Donatello and Brunelleschi and Leonardo. I mean, there's probably a greater concentration of great artists perhaps at any time in history, with the possible exception of 5th century BC Athens. So it was very much a part of the fabric of life. It was commissioned by churches to promote religion. It was collected by the great merchants who wanted to turn their houses into sort of palaces of culture. So it was natural for somebody who grew up at that time to sort of think that art was an essential part of the fabric of life. For Michelangelo in particular, though, I think he wanted to turn it into something else. He wanted to turn it almost into a philosophy or theology in stone or in paint. He really elevated, instead of being merely an adjunct to religion, he wanted to express and expand the notion of what one's relationship with God could be through art, in the case of something like the David, to really express the potential of man through art, to really create a new image of man as this creature who could do anything he chose, be anything he wanted. This was the great age of sort of humanism, in which the sort of human animal once again becomes the center of focus rather than simply the hereafter. So he really, I think, was one of those few artists, along with Raphael and Leonardo, really transformed through art our sense of man's place in the universe.
How did he win the commission to do the David, which I suppose was it could have been lost to Da Vinci or other artists as well?
Yeah. Well, he happened to be in Rome when he first heard rumors that board that oversaw the Duomo in Florence, the Cathedral of Florence, were looking at this. There had been this large marble monolith sitting in the yard there for decades, unfinished. And they decided to revive the commission to sculpt a David for the cathedral. So he runs back to Florence, partly because he was afraid that Leonardo da Vinci would snag it. And if there's one thing that was going to drive Michelangelo crazy, was the idea that an artist who was primarily known as a painter, even if he was the most famous painter of the day, would get a commission in his hometown that he, as a sculptor, felt he deserved. And in truth, it's not clear that Da Vinci had that much interest in the commission, but it did goad Michelangelo to sort of run back to Florence and to seize the moment, and he created, he had already created the Pietà, and this had made him famous, and so he was sort of in a good position to take it. He had to create a small model of what he was going to do for the overseers of the cathedral, partly because this huge marble column had already been hacked out by a rather inexpert sculptor, and it was difficult to see how you could fit a figure into it. So Michelangelo had to convince them by making a small wax model that he could actually fit his figure into this form. And once he had done that, he was given the commission. And again, it's no surprise after the fame of the Pietà that he was sort of the, you know, the great new talent on the scene, and he was also a native son of Florence, which helped.
And David, of course, is a figure from the Bible, but there was sort of an element of civic pride in the placement of the sculpture as well.
Yeah. David had long been a traditional symbol of the Florentine Republic. And one has to understand that Florence in those days wasn't simply a small city. It was actually a sovereign state. It was a small state, and it was constantly in danger of being swallowed up by the large nation states of France and Spain, who at the time were sort of crisscrossing the peninsula, sort of gobbling up whatever they could and sort of trampling on the fields of the native Italians and otherwise creating havoc. So it was a period of great threat for the Florentine Republic. They felt themselves under siege, and they wanted the David as a symbol of civic pride. David, who is the underdog, the virtuous warrior of the Lord, who conquers his heathen enemy, was a sort of wonderful symbol for the underdog Florentine Republic. And even though the work was originally commissioned for the cathedral, as soon as it was sort of halfway done, the leaders of Florence began to see that this was a much more potent symbol of the Republic if they could put it right in front of the government palace. And if you go to Florence today, you'll see a full-size replica of the David where for hundreds of years it stood right in front of the government palace where the citizens of Florence would see it as they went in and out on their way to debate the great issues of the day. So it was a great symbol of civic pride, and really the Florentines needed, you know, this heroic figure to tell them that they could really, against all the odds, you know, as underdogs, conquer the great giant Goliath.
How did Michelangelo feel about the time he spent living and working in Rome?
He had very mixed feelings about Rome. He was a Florentine through and through, with all the pride and arrogance and assumption that Florentines were better than everybody else, including Romans. Rome at that time was Michelangelo's first patron, Lorenzo the Magnificent, called a sink of all iniquities. When he first went to Rome, the Pope was Alexander VI, the famous Borgia Pope, whose daughter had a daughter, Lucrezia, of infamy, and a son, Cesare Borgia, who went around rampaging across the peninsula. And it was a very corrupt place. Not only did the Pope have many children that he acknowledged, but he was rumored to poison the cardinals whose wealth he wanted to acquire for himself. It was very corrupt. It was very violent with the great feudal families, fighting each other in the streets, and a lot of violence. And so it was but on the other hand, it was the great stage on which an artist could perform. The popes and the cardinals had the money, they had the ambition. So if you wanted to be, if you wanted to make it there, if you wanted to make it in Rome, if you could make it in Rome, you could make it anywhere. It was really the place you had to be if you were an artist of great ambition. So he, sort of blew hot and cold. He traveled back and forth between Florence and Rome at various times in his life. And at one point he, after Florence had sort of lost all its charm for him for a variety of reasons, he also goes back to Rome because he's fallen in love, and he wants to return to be where his love is. And so he had a very complicated relationship with Rome. And after his death, there was a big kind of comic battle between Rome and Florence for his remains, where he would be buried, and ultimately the Florentines had to sneak his body out of Rome in a bale of hay, so the Romans wouldn't know they were sort of stealing this, whom they consider their sort of great artist.
What can we know about how he himself conceived of his physical and emotional attraction to other men?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I've often, people often ask me, well, was Michelangelo gay? And it's sort of it's an impossible question to answer because, on the one hand, I think if he were alive today, he would almost certainly consider himself gay. He his main attractions were to other men. The great love of his life was a young Roman nobleman named Tommaso di Cavalieri. But the problem with simply saying, oh, okay, he was gay and that's an end of it, is that there was no such thing as being gay in Renaissance Italy. And it was not simply that the word didn't exist. It was that they sort of divided up sexuality and conceived of it in a quite different way than we do today. They basically, on the one hand, were much more intolerant. They considered sexuality in almost any form sinful. The only form in which it was tolerated was between a married man and a woman. And that was just, you know, that was sort of accepted for practical reasons. But there was a great stigma against all sexual desire.
It was for making babies, and that was kind of
right.
The end of it.
Mm-hmm. So what this meant is that they grouped everything else sort of in the same category. You know, sort of if you visited a prostitute, if you had illicit affairs with other women, if you committed adultery. So they didn't define the main division wasn't between those who were attracted to their own sex versus those who were attracted to the opposite sex. And in fact, they sort of assumed that if you gave unbridled license to your lust, you would be attracted to pretty much anything. That's, you know, they had a kind of openness about, well, you know, sex is sinful, but it's anarchic, and sexual desire is this kind of uncontrollable thing. But they didn't sort of break it down in terms of same-sex versus, you know, heterosexual relations. They simply saw it all. So in a way, that was almost expected of a young man to sort of dally in all sorts of forms of sexuality with people, with members of his own sex, the opposite sex. It was not approved of, but, you know, it was sort of, there was a much more kind of amorphous and, it was not dualistic in the way that it is largely regarded now.
Let's talk about the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. It is an astonishing work to witness. It also turns out to be rather astonishing that the thing got done, given all the complications with that commission.
Yeah, well, like most of the projects that Michelangelo took on, well, this one he took on reluctantly because he had always said, painting is not my art. It's obviously, it was one of the great ironies of art history that perhaps the greatest painting ever made was made by a man who claimed not to be a painter. But he sort of had to be dragged kicking and screaming by Pope Julius to do it, and it was an enormous task. And normally, if you took on a task like this, it would, you know, you would require dozens of assistants who would help you out. And this is the way Michelangelo himself worked as a pupil in the studio of the Ghirlandaio brothers, the young man, where he would, you know, the master would sort of supervise, but a lot of the actual figures were painted by assistants, and who had, you know, dozens of people grinding the colors. And Michelangelo actually tried this in the beginning because he realized that it was such a monumental task. But he was such a perfectionist, and that he would fire his assistants at a moment's notice. And Vasari, his friend and biographer, said that, you know, after a few weeks, he basically locked the doors and wouldn't let anybody else in. So he basically did the whole thing himself, which is not quite true. We can recognize the hand of a few other artists in a couple of the very minor parts of the ceiling. But by and large, Michelangelo, I think, is what we, and he was not a team player. He was a perfectionist, partly because he was so, he needed to impose his own personality, his own vision on the work. And if he had ceded any authority, any responsibility to assistants, that singularity would have been lost. And I think one of the reasons that the Sistine Chapel and his other works have such enormous impact is one can really feel behind them a single mind, a single vision. And this was in part because he was so demanding, and he really did almost everything himself. And then, of course, there are the usual sort of vicissitudes of war, and it was interrupted when Julius, the Pope, strapped on his armor and went off to war and then was almost defeated. But he managed to persevere and managed to complete it, this enormous undertaking, in about 4 years, despite all the hassles and the enormous amount of work that went into it.
What was his relationship to money?
To money? He had a difficult relationship with money, I think in part because of his the poverty of his youth. He always felt that he was poor, even when he became what in our terms would probably be considered a millionaire. He ultimately bought enormous amounts of property in and around Florence, partly because he was very insecure about money, and he was one of these people who felt that, you know, if you sink your money into property, that's safe. You know, that's the most safest form of wealth. Despite pleading poverty for most of his life, he ended up a very wealthy man. But he'd often got into trouble because he would take commissions. For instance, right before he sculpted the David, he took a commission from an important cardinal to make some sculptures for a tomb in Siena. But as soon as the offer to do the David came along, he sort of drops that one and goes on to the David, which he found a much more interesting, if not more lucrative, commission. So then, of course, his patrons who were sort of left in the lurch would obviously be angry and say, you know, you haven't fulfilled the terms of your contract. We've given you money, but you produced nothing. And so he was constantly being sued by people. And I don't think this was because Michelangelo was not really grasping. I mean, he didn't do it for the money, but he was very sort of insecure about he always felt he could sort of slide back into poverty. So was very sort of, he could be very tight-fisted. Although he could also be very generous when he would give money to the widow of his assistant and very generously support her and her children. So he was sort of a mixed bag. But I think, again, that sort of poverty, you know, sort of being born into poverty and then suddenly finding yourself with money, like many of those people, he had a kind of almost paranoid insecurity about it.
Miles J. Unger is with us. We're speaking about his new book, Michelangelo, A Life in Six Masterpieces. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration opens August 5th. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with former contributing writer for The New York Times, Miles J. Unger, author of the new book, Michelangelo, A Life in Six Masterpieces. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. Miles, we know that Michelangelo was deeply religious. How closely, though, did his concept of divinity cleave to the doctrine of the Catholic Church?
That's a very interesting question, and one that got very complicated, particularly later in life when he painted The Last Judgment. You have to remember that Michelangelo lived through a tumultuous time in the history of the Christian religion in 1517, when Martin Luther nailed the 95 Theses to the church door in Wittenberg, ushering in the Protestant Revolution. Michelangelo was in Rome at that time, and soon was to paint The Last Judgment. But he became involved at this time with many Catholics who were troubled in much the same way that Luther was with the corruption of the church, but were not willing to sort of go all the way and break with the Catholic Church. He became involved with a group known as the Spirituali, the Spirituals, and was very good friends with one of the leading lights of that movement, a woman named Vittoria Colonna. And they espoused a much more personal relationship with God. And this was something that was in tension with the Catholic Church, which thought that one's relationship with God should be mediated through ritual, through the sacraments, through the priest, through the church. And when he paints the Last Judgment, many people saw the Last Judgment as an expression of this kind of belief, an almost heretical belief according to the Catholic Church. His, Michelangelo's, version of the Last Judgment differs from almost any one in the past, in that it's very hard to sort of distinguish the saved from the sinners. Normally in a Last Judgment there are all these sort of signs, you know, these attributes of the saints telling you sort of, you know, there are all these signposts that sort of say, you, through this, if you do this, you will get into heaven. Michelangelo's conception is much more chaotic, much more sort of frightening, and this sort of relates to that sort of belief that, you know, salvation is never assured, that salvation is a matter of a personal relationship with God, of sort of bringing Christ into your heart, rather than the kind of rituals that the church espoused. And one sees in some of the drawings he did around this time in the 1530s, and also an equally kind of anguished and sort of notion of a need to be closer to God, but also a feeling of a sense of his own sinfulness. He wrote in a well-known poem. He writes, I want, O Lord, to want what I don't want. Sort of acknowledging his own sinfulness, his own, how difficult it was to live up to the principles, to live up to his own religious faith, and that kind of anguished notion sort of gets its most powerful expression in the famous self-portrait he inserts into the Last Judgment, in which he paints his self-portrait as the flayed skin of St. Bartholomew, as this kind of sack of empty flesh. But it's clearly still recognizably Michelangelo's features, and this kind of depiction of himself in this horrific, sort of this empty shell of a man sort of reflects his kind of own conflicted and anguished notion and relationship with God, and his own sort of acknowledgement of his own sinfulness, which may in turn have something to do with his own sort of sense of his conflicted sexuality.
Are there things that you can learn about the way his mind worked from the poetry, from the documents, from the correspondence he left behind that is not necessarily evident in the works themselves?
Yeah, I think he was among his other, aside from being the sort of greatest sculptor, painter, and architect of his age, he was probably also the greatest poet in the Italian at that time. And he expresses a lot of the ideas he expresses in his poetry, I think, add a great depth of understanding to the work. Thinking particularly of those poems where he talks about the soul being imprisoned in the body, and this is something that comes out of both Christianity and that sort of tension between, you know, the flesh and the spirit, but also the philosophy of Neoplatonism, which he learned as a young man in the palace of Lorenzo de' Medici, where he associated with the great sort of philosophers of the day. But he talks often about the sort of the prison or of sloughing off his skin and becoming a purer form, sort of sloughing off the kind of sinful carnal nature to get at something more pure. And I think if you look particularly at his unfinished sculptures, particularly the famous ones in the Accademia in Florence, where you see the form of the body emerging from the stone, but still not yet released from the stone, that one sees that connection to the poetry, that idea of form, of meaning sort of emerging slowly out of matter, which has a great deal in common with that sort of Neoplatonist philosophy of the tension between the flesh and the spirit, and what they call the carcere terreno, the earthly prison of the body.
How did he come to work on St. Peter's Basilica?
He came to work on it as an old man, a decade and a half before his death. He'd lived a very long life at that time. He was almost 89 when he died. So in his 70s, he takes on the most monumental building project in history up to that time. He was given it by his good friend, Pope Paul III, and he took it on as a kind of labor of love and a last tribute to his God. I mean, he was feeling his own mortality. He wanted something that would sort of perhaps get things right with God, a kind of, you know, penance, or doing something in service to God. So he takes on this monumental project, I think in part because he was, frankly, fatigued. You know, fresco painting and sculpture were much more physically demanding. Architecture was something you did with your mind. It was considered a more scholarly pursuit. He was also an enormously inventive architect. I think he was bursting with architectural ideas, and he saw what was going on with the greatest church in Christendom and sort of, you know, and said, you know, they're making a horrible mess of this, and he was happy to sort of, you know, he professed that, you know, he said, oh, I'm, you know, reluctant to take this on, which is what he always said, you know, I'm just doing this for the love of God. But he really, I think, was also burning with ambition to show what he could do. It's a little hard to sort of tease out Michelangelo's contribution to the church that was built over 150 years and had, you know, six or seven different master architects working with it. But if you know the dome of St. Peter's and the so-called hemicycles in the back of the building, he really gave it a much more coherent shape. He gave it its most visible and powerful symbol in the soaring dome that you can see from practically anywhere in Rome. He famously said that he wouldn't take a salary, that this was his tribute to God. He was doing this for the love of God and the love of the Pope and the love of the Church. It was a great project that took up the last decade and a half of his life.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Cheryl on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. Very fascinating topic. Thank you very much. I wanted to ask about the Julius II tomb project and the way that the Pope is actually depicted in the monument. I know the tomb was supposed to be much, much bigger, but the way that Julius II is sort of, I don't know, laying there very unconventionally, was that part of the design, or was that some way that Michelangelo was getting back at the Pope in some way? I'm just interested in your perspective.
Yeah, that really had nothing, very little to do with Michelangelo. Michelangelo called the Julius tomb the tragedy of the tomb, and by the time it was completed, he had really washed his hands of it. And in fact, if he hadn't been such a control freak, he would have given it up long ago. Other artists said to him, you know, don't worry if it doesn't come out right. Nobody will blame you for you know, if it turns out, you know, if it's a mess, you know, it's not your fault. So he ultimately gave it up to others to complete, and he himself really only sculpted three works for that. The wonderful David, which is one of the great sculptures he ever did and sort of dwarfs the rest of the monument, and the Rachel and the Leah on either side. But other than that, he really wasn't responsible for the final design of the tomb, which was carried out by others.
How were audiences of the day, how did they respond to Michelangelo's frequent use of nudity?
It depended on the age. Michelangelo lived a long life, and he lived really from the heyday of the Renaissance with its humanism and its interest in pagan mythology. But he also lived through the Counter-Reformation, the Reformation, and the Inquisition. So when he painted the Sistine ceiling and he painted all those nude figures, people barely batted an eye. But 20 years later, when he comes to paint the Last Judgment, and this was, you know, after the Reformation and the Church was trying to sort of reform itself, they cast a much more skeptical eye on what they considered indecent. And in fact, Pope Paul IV insisted ultimately on covering up the most offensive parts of the Last Judgment, because it was by that time, and people said that it was something more suitable for a bathhouse or a brothel than for a house of God. Michelangelo spans an age, and his art sort of spans two different ages in which the attitudes, I think Michelangelo himself was kind of surprised when he finished it, and everybody objected to those things that seemed perfectly acceptable in the same, you know, in the ceiling right above where the Last Judgment was painted.
Can you imagine being the like cleanup artist called in to cover up nudity in a Michelangelo painting?
Yeah, well, fortunately, it was given to a friend of his. It was actually a process that took, you know, I think over 100 years to get it all done. But the first one to do it was a friend of his named Daniele da Volterra, who, and unfortunately for him, ended up getting the nickname Il Braghettone, which means the breeches maker, sort of the underwear maker, because he's, you know, sort of, that's what he's known for, is, you know, painting, you know, loincloths and all this on the figures and The Last Judgment. It's probably not what he wanted his epitaph to read, but
we know that Michelangelo had assistants. Did he take on proteges in any capacity?
He was one of these people who had a difficult time dealing with people of real talent, with Leonardo da Vinci, with Raphael, with Titian. He always felt in competition, so that the people he tended to surround himself with were mediocrities. And so it's unfortunate because he did not leave any real students. He didn't run a shop like somebody like Raphael did, where his assistants contributed a lot. But he had sort of, you know, when he did use assistants, they were assigned very menial tasks. And as I said, he preferred mediocrities, the people who could really challenge him. Though he was enormously influential, he created a whole, his later work spawned an entire movement in art from the mid-16th century known as Mannerism, which comes out of some of the work that Michelangelo did in The Last Judgment and the Medici tombs. But these were artists who were influenced by him rather than students of him.
How much of what remains of his work in the world today is unfinished?
Well, there are different ways of looking at unfinished. There are more unfinished works by Michelangelo than most artists, largely because he was so famous and so revered that works that would have been by lesser artists that normally would have been tossed as being, you know, unfinished, inadequate, you know, not worth very much, were treasured. So we have, you know, the great unfinished captives in the Academia Museum and in the Louvre. We have the two great, late great Pietas, one in Florence and one in Milan, because they were sort of treasured. It's also true that Michelangelo had this habit of sort of abandoning one project to take on a new one, thereby sort of leaving the last one incomplete. So there's a fair amount of you know, works at various stages of completion that he, you know, his career is strewn with. But again, in a way, that's a good thing, as I said, because, you know, there's much preserved that would not otherwise, that if he had been less famous, would never have lasted through the ages.
The new book by Miles J. Unger is called Michelangelo, A Life in Six Masterpieces. Miles, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Christina Alsh. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.